Log Talk Radio.
On the Edge, real talk about real issues.
Welcome to the On the Edge Show with Katie Barnett and friends. I'm your host, Katie Barnett. Well, it's a Monday, everybody. We made it to the beginning of a new week. We want to thank the Lord for allowing us another opportunity to be here. I want to begin with our shout-outs to Barry Mason, formerly of 98.7 Kiss FM Radio in New York City. He is currently with iSoulRadio.com. You can hear Barry do his thing on Saturdays from 7 to 10 p.m. and on Sundays from 6 to 10 p.m. Also, an announcement to make. When we give our shout-outs to Stephanie Hammond-Tillette and Marcia Morgan of Simply Sensational, Inc. Entertainment, tomorrow night, for those of you who have not yet purchased a ticket or have been in touch with these ladies, tomorrow night in Lower Manhattan, New York, at the Albella Lounge, is going to be a very special fundraiser, the Comedy Cares event, with a bunch of very, very famous and funny comedians honoring Sugar Bear and Roz G. And they will be raising funds for allowing freelancers to come up with health care insurance as well as awareness for men and women to get their health checked, and men in particular, because men don't like to go to the doctor and men are getting more sick by the dozen. So please, if you don't already know where to go, if you plan to, see Stephanie Hammond-Tillette on Facebook. Contact me here at the show. And know that the donations for the tickets are only $10 and they're tax deductible. So you can have fun for $10 and be doing something for a good cause. So please, once again, look out for the Comedy Cares posting. That's all over Facebook. Reach out to Stephanie Hammond-Tillette, Marcia Morgan, or Katie Barnett, and you will be able to get connected to the right place. I want to shout out PS37, Cynthia Jenkins School in Queens, New York, to Beverly Mitchell, Dory Robinson, Ms. Pedicini, Mackenzie Cameron, for all that you have been doing, to the PTA people out there, to all of you in that school for being wonderful participants for our Youth Day events here on Saturdays and for helping us bridge the gaps in our students and the communities around them. We want to thank you very much. Look for some upcoming contests that we'll be having with schools nationwide as well as announcements for the school itself. I want to thank my team, Lady Diamond, Elaine Yeves, Monster Miles, and Deacon Betty Williams, activist for Toledo, Ohio, three of the most wonderful people that have made this show be where it is. I want to shout out to the group, the Real World Black News and Discussions Group, because they have been actively involved with helping us with pre-topic broadcast feedback as well as bringing topics to our awareness. So I want to thank all of you very much. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to be touching on a very, very important issue, and it's going to be one of three parts. We will start with part one today. Part two and three will air on Wednesday and Thursday. And one of the things that makes this so special is that tonight, I and my daughter, we will be sharing stories of our own personal experiences with having survived being victims of crimes and abuse. And we need to share what we've gone through as well as allow all of you to understand that there is a way to break the cycles and the chains and the handcuffs of being a victim to the crime that was committed against you, to the trauma that took place in your life. We have ways. Also, to you loved ones of these survivors, for those of you that have been feeling helpless and not knowing how to do anything, for those of you that have been frustrated and fed up and want to walk away because you feel that this person is treating you in a way that's about you, it really isn't. And tonight, if you can, I urge you to please grab a pen and a paper, a notebook, anything that you can take enough notes on so that you can refer back and also listen into the archive when the show is over, anytime that you need to hear something that can help you in your specific situation. We need to help victims overcome, because a trauma or a crime can stay with you for life. And it can affect you if it happened to you as a child. It can affect you well into your adult life, and you can either spread it, or you can contain it, or you can be indifferent. And either way, two of those things are not so great. So I would like for all of you to really pay attention. Please chime in anytime that you want to ask a question or share a story. The number here is 347-327-9967. And you are welcome at any point in time to share your story, to ask a question, to ask us questions if you like. Now, my daughter is involved with a youth advocacy meeting tonight for one of her schools, and I will be on her behalf speaking of her story and mine, as she has given me full authority to. And I will let you know how you can take tragedy and make it something that is your biggest catalyst for overcoming. So you know how we do this. This is going to be an early break, and what better way to go out with it than to talk about being tired of being tired of being tired of being a victim. So we're going to go out with Kelly Price is Tired. Be back here in 3.5 minutes.
There's a hole in my heart. My soul is bleeding. I need to free my mind. And see what guilty feeling.
Tired
of the broken dreams.
Tired
of the broken dreams.
Tired
of the baby mama.
Tired
of the ghetto drama.
Tired
of the back and forth. Tired of in and out the court.
You're listening to On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. And I believe that's one hell of a powerful song by a powerful lung singer. I want to start tonight off with a story. There was a child that was born at the age of 9 to 14. She had already experienced the bad problems of people in her family, or that was supposed to be family and protecting her, violating what was innocent about her life. Because of that, she grew up believing she wasn't pretty, that her sisters were prettier, that there was not enough that was good about her, that everybody, you know, pretty much wanted to target her for abuse, sexually in particular. And she developed an attitude of fighting for herself. At 16, she had pretty much been able to take on the world and stand up for herself. And pretty much, this was okay. She was an avid writer. She took her pain and her anger and whatever it was, and she channeled it into literary work, poetry, writing scripts, and dancing. She used to choreograph for other kids her age who went through stuff because she knew what it was like to feel like there was nobody for her. So she created peer age group where she taught dance, and they had local talent shows, and they stayed off the streets and kept people from seeing teens gathered on corners in the summer months, even to the point where the community began to respect her and to look forward to seeing these performances, and the parents of the people she rallied up in the group were starting to come to her and say, my child won't be able to rehearse today because she didn't do her homework. So quite a bit of that started to help her get her self-esteem back, or at least to feel important to that point. And she stayed in dancing, and she stayed in her writing. And then one day, when she was 16 years old, she went to go stay with a friend of hers, looking for her little sister, because their mom was crying, and she went to go look for her little sister, who was always running around and doing things that weren't so great. And there was a best friend of hers that had three beautiful little sisters and an older brother, and the best friend and the older brother were helping to raise their little sisters because their mom had to travel and sleep in to support them. So she went over to look for her sister who was at this girl's house, and when she got there, she helped to put the little sisters to sleep. She smiled and played and read stories, and the older brother told her that both of our sisters are not here yet, but they paged me and they're on their way. The man kept going out and coming back in telling her, okay, well, they're on their way. They just beeped. They're on their way. Well, he started to tell this 16-year-old girl just how pretty he thought she was and how nice he was, and would she be interested, and she told him no, over and over again, no, you're a really nice guy, you're a sweet person, but you're a good friend, and I'm not interested. Well, he kept on going out to say that our sisters will be back, they're on their way. And then the 16-year-old girl, who is sitting there waiting for her little sister, asked the man for a glass of water. Well, halfway through the glass of water, the 16-year-old girl got very sleepy. And when she woke up, she was in a dark room with a radio playing a bunch of music, nice music, romantic music from 107.5's Quiet Storm in New York. And she realized she was in a strange bed with someone laying next to her in a dark room, and she didn't know what. When she turned around, the same person told her, I don't want you to be afraid, but I really like you. And she started to scream, I told you I'm not into this. I don't want to be bothered. Did you let me go? Well, he did not. And for 6 hours, he raped the 16-year-old girl, letting her know there was no way she could be heard because he was in the soundproof music room in which he slept because he did music. And nobody would be able to hear her screams, and that their sisters were never coming. Okay, well, when the next day came and she was finally able to leave, she ran and she went and locked herself in a room, in an apartment that was supposed to be abandoned. And she locked herself in a room, and she would never come out. And because this was a nice guy that everybody in the neighborhood thought was a sweet, upstanding person, it started to become a his word against her thing, until a cop came to this lady and said, "I know you. You're a happy person, and you haven't been happy for 2 weeks. What's going on?" And this whole 2 weeks after this event took place, this 16-year-old girl refused to believe that there was any help or that anybody would listen. And what happened was the cop knew, and the cop sort of coerced the 16-year-old girl to tell the story, and she told it in a hypothetical form, and the cop wasn't stupid. He knew that the hypothetical friend that this girl was talking about was actually herself. And he said, "You're coming with me to tell your story because this could happen to someone else." When she broke down and started crying in a local laundromat. So from there, she decided to fight back, and she went in and she filed charges. Not knowing anything after the police tell you to come file charges that you're supposed to be at court the next day or he gets released. Well, when she found out that he was released from jail and all hell started to break loose because the neighbors and his sister, everyone started to come back after this victim, she found out that a cop told her that someone came down there on her behalf to tell them that she wanted to drop the charges because she was not well enough to come down and do it herself. So he walked. And from there, the taunting for this victim got worse because he was the local, I don't know, supplier for the neighborhood. The taunting got worse to the point where this 16-year-old girl decided to try to end her life with pills. And what helped her was she got into this psych ward that they help mental patients who try to commit suicide get through things, and she started seeing the craziest of people, like 30-year-old men pretending they were babies, and she prayed to God that if he was to get her out of there, she would never again try to deal with bad problems by trying to end her own life, and she never did. Ladies and gentlemen, that 16-year-old girl is me. I had to deal with hatred both to him and from his people. I had to deal with hating the fact that I didn't see it coming. I had to deal with the fact that, why me? I had to deal with that. I had to deal with the fact that the police failed me after forcing me to come out of my shell. They failed me, that the system failed me, that all it took was that he was a nice, quiet, sweet guy, and he wasn't the average fighter on the street. And then there was a question. People that knew me for years, knew my character inside and out, that could bet their lottery winnings and know they would always get it back, started to question whether this guy who decided to amp up the sympathy and start crying even. Now I turned out to be the big bad wolf. No one knew this guy. I had me trapped for 6 hours, from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning, not letting me leave, trying to force me to react, my body to react to him in ways that I felt was my only way to be in control, was not to give him what he wanted. And it affected me in many ways. I didn't trust people. I didn't believe love was real. I didn't believe that I was pretty because pretty people don't get hurt. Pretty people don't, nobody wants to hurt beautiful things. And I started to learn little by little, and I started to pick the wrong people in my life because slowly but surely, I had two relationships after that, both of my children's fathers. And what happened was, they were exactly like him. And like my childhood attackers. But I promised myself that my children would never see that. They would never go through it. I was going to be different. And I had babies. And then, about 17 years later, I'm here to speak about another story. On Good Friday of 2009, 12-year-old girl and her mom are arguing because her mother got wind through her cell phone that she was talking to people that everybody in the neighborhood had reputed to be dangerous. And up until that point, the mom had always trusted her daughter and just pretty much did random searches. But everything about this child was perfect. She was doing great grades. She was very respectable. She had just come from performing in church for Easter. So everything was all right. And she was grounded for something that she did. So when she asked her mother, could she go to the movies, her mother said no. But she said, you can call your father to get permission or not. Well, she called her dad, got permission, said, I love you, Mom, and she went out and she was able to go to the movies with all three of her girlfriends. And then the movie was already about 25 minutes past the end time, and the mom couldn't reach her daughter, nor was the GPS in her phone being activated. Well, she now got upset with her daughter, and she said, well, she's trying to be slick and close down the phone so her mom can't track her, but that's not going to happen. So she called 911 to report her daughter missing. Well, this 12-year-old girl finally calls her mom and tells her mother that I'm at the bus stop. I'm at the bus at the terminal that goes to the house, and I should be there. Now, at that time of day, the buses were really quick, so the mom told her, you better be here in 7 minutes because that's how long it takes for the bus to get here at this time. Well, she said, okay, I'm on the bus now. So the mom timed her. And then when she put out the last search on the GPS in the phones, it confirmed that her daughter was indeed at the bus stop, which was a half, about three or four houses down away from their house. As the mom went to go put on her clothes and put on her shoes and her coat to go meet her daughter personally at the bus stop, when she got there, the 12-year-old daughter was gone. 12-year-old daughter had been abducted by a gang right from the bus stop in less than 5 minutes. That daughter is my daughter. She was 12 years old, taken by a chapter of a local gang that the police have been watching for quite some time, forced into captivity in a house that we later found out was directly behind the school that was across the street from our house, that the police had been watching this house for other activity. When she was reported missing, the police called the suspects to ask if they had her. She had been the target of this gang's recruiting team, who recruited young girls right off of the schoolyard, pretending that they wanted to date them so that they could recruit them into prostitution. For 5 days, I went crazy. We had helicopters. We had squad cars. We circled the area 80 times. For 5 days, I waited for the call for them to tell me they had found my daughter in a park somewhere. For 5 days, I couldn't find her. Finally, on the fifth day, I got three calls in a half an hour from a restricted number. Sprint PCS at the time was our cell phone carrier there. They had been wonderful up to the point of helping us find her. They were helping us trace her last calls, her last activity, where she was, the last location from the GPS family locator. And I called them and I asked, if I could give you the times that she had called me. She called me from private numbers. Is there a way that you can unblock the number? And they said to me, Ms. Barnett, yes, we can, but we cannot give it to you. But if a policeman will call and verify your story and verify who they are, we can give it to them. Well, I'm happy now because it's day five and I call this detective. And I said to the detective, Sprint said, if you call them, they'll give you the number to where she just called. She just called me from three times in the last half hour looking to speak to our little brothers and sisters. Well, this detective told me That's not true. It's going to take 2 weeks to get a subpoena just to get to the records. Then it's going to take us about 4 weeks to go through all of the phone records. And I kindly told him I already spoke to Sprint and gave them written authorization to give you the numbers that was called. And you don't need to look through anything because I already know the date and times that she called. I have them for you. Well, after making me feel like yet again the police had failed my daughter, they called me back in 10 minutes to give me not only the number, but the name of the person that the number belonged to, who we knew, and we knew exactly where this person was. I had a PIN petition out of my daughter, which in New York City, that's a standing warrant to find a juvenile who has been deemed by a court to be a danger to herself or to other people in her behavior. Well, that was supposed to be my ticket to finding my daughter. Well, when we found out who it was, we went right there because I got a neighbor to tell me that they had spotted my daughter going into the very place that the police had eventually found her. Well, I stopped a squad car, and I told them, my daughter's in here. Here's a PINS petition, and she's in that house. They weren't supposed to do nothing but go straight to the house and bust down the door to look for her. What they told me was, are you sure she's missing, ma'am? Because, frankly, you know, you said she called you, which means she's not missing. So I asked them, what dictionary did they read to get the definition for missing, meaning that a person called but you still can't find them? And that all the phone calls proved was that she was missing but not dead. So I was so frustrated. I said, to hell with you, you useless people. And I started storming the streets in my bare feet and no coat, looking for my daughter. I screamed in everybody's face and knocked on everybody's door to demand that they give my daughter back, because this was no runaway. This was my child. And it wasn't until I came back frustrated yet again that my neighbor called Steve Wilkos. And for those of you who don't know, Steve Wilkos is a show host on TV. He used to be a cop. My neighbors, without me knowing, had called and told of everything that the police were doing and what I went through. And they called me to ask me to tell my story to them on the phone. And then they asked me again to tell me what the police had did and about the Sprint PCS tracing and all this stuff. And then said, and after all of that, they still didn't do anything. And I said, no. And I'll never forget that the production assistant's name was Lynn, and she said, I'm going to call you right back. Well, she didn't call me back, but 15 minutes later, SVU came in and said, we're going in that house to get your daughter. And 10 minutes after that, my daughter was rescued, which was exactly 10 days instead of the 5 days it should have been. They found her. Well, my daughter has authorized me to share that. For 3 years, she didn't know she was a victim. They conditioned the young girls to believe that they're their protectors and that they're their survivors and they're the ones that take care of them and that their parents don't care about them, that they will be the ones to buy you clothes and to give you food and to take care of you. And all that you have to do in return is go out there and bring $1,000 a night on your back turning tricks, which they locked her up during school hours, and they put her on a site called Backpage.com, and they sold her out every night. From 13 to 16, my daughter did not realize she was a victim. She fought against everybody. She ran wild. At age 17, I'm proud to say that my daughter has become an advocate for other girls that have gone through that. She has spoken with the commissioner of New York. She has gone on community activist programs, and she has advocated and helped other girls that have gone through it. And she has asked me to share our stories so that we could tell you how we overcame. So to give me about 5 minutes to compose myself and get that started, I'm going to go to a short break. I see my panelists are on there, and I will be bringing you in to discuss it. The song that I'm going to be going out with also is for all you victims and myself. It's by Kelly Clarkson, and it's called Stronger. Be back in 3.5 minutes.
Feels warmer sleeping here alone. You know I dream in color.
You're listening to On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge show, and I'm stronger. Okay, I want to bring in our first panelist for the evening, and then we will get into talking about how we are going to help all of these victims break the cycle given to them by their assailants, by the people who have been culprits of hell in their life. And we are going to get started, and hopefully that all of you will walk away from this, at least for part one of this segment, with some changes. Okay, just 1 minute. Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, Katie, what's going on?
Hey, Rod, how are you? Welcome in. Hold on, I have one more, okay?
Alrighty.
Welcome to the show, caller.
Hi, Katie, it's Lady Diamond. How are you?
Hi, Lady Di. Okay, well, we're here right now. Rod, do you have any comments?
I came in on the tail end of your encounter with the devils there. I heard you say something. They were slow to react.
That was
they
my daughter's
permission. They needed permission to go in and get her.
Okay, well, what you came in on was my daughter's story, and my story was in the beginning. My daughter, on April 2nd of 2009, that was Good Friday, She came back from church. There was a dance group that we had, and they performed for the Good Friday service. They came home, and she and I, we were in a bit of a mom and teen debate because I had found out that in the new school she was in, she started to take up company with kids and a couple of other people that the neighborhood had informed me were not good people, that they were always in trouble, they were stealing or whatever. So up until that point, my daughter and I had a great relationship. It was very open. She was very trustworthy, you know, everything. And so the beginning of the preteen resistance began then when she got found out about these friends. Mm-hmm. And what had happened was that's when she started to rebel. And then, you know, I got involved with her dad and telling them what was going on. And so now there were two hands at the time that was on making sure she was, kept in check.
Okay.
Well, this particular weekend, she was grounded. She was only allowed to go to church to perform and come home. But she had asked me because there was a friend of hers that was the only good friend she had on the block, and the friend was moving. And she had asked the friend, the friend had asked me because I let her please go with her to the movies because she had nobody, and that was her best friend. So I told her, I cannot say yes because I'm going to call her father and ask her father. She needs to call her father and ask if she can go. And her father gave her the permission to go with a strict warning, and she left. She said, Mom, I love you. It's a very early movie, and I'll be back. Now, I had given my older children, cell phones, but they all knew the deal. You don't get a cell phone without Mommy putting GPS in it, so I could find out where you are. So She went to the movies. Everything seemed good. She was on time with everything until the movie that she told me she was going to see, I knew was over, and it was already over for about 20 minutes. So I asked her, where was she? And she told me her battery was dying, but that she was on her way home, that the movie kind of started late, and I told her I didn't believe it, but to get home anyway because it was getting dark, it was starting to get dark. Now, she, her battery, I guess, did die, or she turned the phone off, so for a little while I couldn't track her. And since she was under the court's watch, because I had filed a petition with the court to give me a what they call a person's in need of supervision, and it's acronym is SINS, for children that's under 18, that when they're engaging in such things, such as they're hanging with the wrong people or they're doing drugs or sexual activity, we're allowed to have extra support from the court, that we can report to the court that we've tried everything, and they can get arrested, and then they're put to a place for a little while that's supposed to help them, you know, with behavior reform, like a military school.
Okay.
And because of this, I had a little extra edge to be able to beat the 20, you got to wait 24 hours before reporting your child missing thing, and I was able to call 911 because I was afraid that she was with the guy that these kids had been hanging around and the neighbors told me was no good. So as I was on the phone with 911, I tried the GPS locator one more time, and she had called me and said she already got on the bus and she was going to be home, and that only took 7 minutes because it was one of those slow traffic times, and it's a very short ride from where they were to where we were.
Okay.
Anyway, I said, okay, well, I expect you here in 10 minutes, 7 to 10 minutes. So as I was saying that, I was locating her, and then the GPS came back and told me that your daughter is right there. It's like, you know, pretty much that this phone number is right there at the bus stop that's at my house. So I threw my shoes on and ran out, which is like a little half curve to the place, but by that time, they had already taken her in that short time.
Mm-hmm.
So we scoured every place, then I called, the police came, and then everything started. Now, what happened was the police looked around the parks, they looked around the neighborhoods, the stores, and then they looked in the last place that we knew the guy was, that was turned out to be a young recruit for the gang that took her. And
all right.
What happened was they went around to the house that they knew him to be at. They didn't see anything. They didn't bother going to the door to do anything. They called him on the phone to ask him, did he have her?
Mm-hmm.
They called the suspect on the phone to ask if they had her. And then they called again 3 times from their office throughout the week. She was first missing 5 days. On the 5th day, I got a call from her. from an unrestricted number 3 times because she wanted to speak to her little brothers and her little sister.
Uh-huh.
Well, what happened was I was telling her, and she goes to me, "Mom, stop looking for me. I'm in a better place now, and, you know, I don't want any trouble."
In a better place than home? How's that?
That's what the pimp that had her was telling her to say, and he made her break her phone so I couldn't locate her. And,
all right.
So she called me the first time to say that. I said, "Okay, you out of your mind or what?" But anyway, after that, I said, I have to play it cool now because I have to not make her think I'm still angry or something. So I started going, "Okay, well, what are you doing? Are you okay? Are you near? Are you being fed?" And she's like, "I'm fine. I'm okay. Please stop trying to look for me." Then she called back, "Can I please speak to the other siblings?" I said, "You can, but they're in school and they'll be out in 10 minutes. I'll call you back in 10 minutes. All 3 times she called me and the number came up restricted. So I called Sprint right away and I said, "Sprint, listen, if you look into your machines, to your screen, you'll see that I've been calling about my daughter for about 10 to 12 times now, asking if you could please trace her last activity and where she was and if there was any new activity. And all of you have been very great." I said, "But I need to know if there's a way that you could unrestrict these numbers that she called me from." I said, "I got my own leads and I need help." And they said, "Miss Barnett, we can, but we cannot give it to you, even with this particular situation. But if the police should call us with your written authorization," which I faxed them immediately, they said to me, "we can give it to them." So I was happy. I thought, we finally got them now. Now we know what's up. So mm-hmm. I called the precinct to the detective that was in charge, and he said to me, "No, that's not true. I don't know who told you that. It's going to take us 2 weeks just to get a warrant to get these records. Then it's going to take us at least 6 weeks to go through all the records." And I told him, in not such a nice way, that that was absolute BS, because I'm the Sprint account holder, and I gave them written authorization to turn over the information to them immediately. And they said if they could verify that they are really cops, if this is a real case, that they'll give it to you. Well, he argued with me about 5 minutes to 10 minutes before he actually called them. And when he did, he called, and I said, "And you don't need to go through all the records, because all you need to know is this date and this time." So after all that mahara that he gave me on the phone, he calls me back in 10 minutes, not just the 3 numbers, but with the name of the girl that it belonged to, and we knew who the girl was and where she lived, and that we knew exactly that that's what we thought all along, where she was. Turns mm-hmm. out that girl was a recruiter / trainer for New Girls. So they knew this because she was in as persons of interest in quite a few other cases, and she'd been arrested for solicitation before. And they mm-hmm. knew the house where this was going on, and they didn't even go in to go look. And they had the authority to do it because a pimp's petition in New York City is a standing search warrant. They can go into any door at any time and bust it in if you said that the subject on this petition was seen in that area, and they don't even have to say that they're sorry. Okay?
All right.
Well, mm-hmm. when I found this out, I ran outside because when my niece came to me and said she had just saw my daughter in the same place that the phone number matched, into the same house. So I ran outside, and I found the squad car, and I said, "Listen, I have a pimp's petition. My daughter's been missing for 6 days now, and this is the deal, and she's in that house." And they didn't move. They were supposed to get up right away, no questions, and just go. And they said to me, "Are you sure she's missing, ma'am? Because you just said that she called you, so technically she's not missing." So excuse my French listeners, I asked them, "Well, what Essen dictionary are you reading that the word missing means she called? It means
she hasn't
that she's
been
not
under your
dead.
House in the last 6 days, so she's missing, right?
Right. Well, they weren't supposed to even give me that 5 minutes of garbage. They were supposed to get the hell in their cars and drive to the place to go get her, and they did it. And she stayed in there for 4 more days before my neighbor couldn't take me breaking down anymore, wondering if she was going to come and be told I was going to get a call telling me to come down to the morgue to come and identify a girl that they found, or she was going to be in the park, or raped, or cut up. Okay? That's what I got. So what happened was my neighbor got upset because I couldn't think about what to do except find her.
Uh-huh.
So she called the Steve Wilkos show, and I don't know if everybody knows who he is. He's the bald-headed white guy that used to be Jerry Springer's bodyguard. He was a former policeman, and he doesn't like garbage. So they called his show, and they told the story, and those people called me. Those people called me to ask me, while I was in the middle of crying and scared and looking out the window and sitting on my roof balcony, wondering if I could see her maybe better than them. helicopters could, I guess. And they asked me to tell me what to tell them what was going on. Then they asked me, so wait a minute, you gave the cops the Sprint PCS how many days ago, and they did what? And they said, I'm going to call you right back.
Mm-hmm.
So she called me back and she asked me again, and you said, now, Sprint gave them permission. You gave Sprint permission. I said, he called me back in 10 minutes after telling me it was going to take 2 weeks. She goes, I'm going to call you right back. And 15 minutes after she said that the second time, SVU came to my house saying that we're going in to go get her. And I believe Steve called that precinct and got into their butts. So what mm-hmm. happened was, 10 minutes after they came to my door, they produced my daughter. And the guys there had drugged her. So she was spaced the hell out, and she was in handcuffs. And the detectives told me that for 10 damn days, my daughter was locked in a janitor's closet, which looked like a janitor's closet, with nothing but a twin mattress and a bottle they allowed her to pee in.
Mm.
They locked her from a padlock on the outside of the door. And she even later told me, one of the days I was out there crying and screaming for her, she looked out the window, and he put a knife to her neck and said, if you scream for help, I'm going to slit your throat.
Jeez.
For 4 years, she didn't understand that these guys are not her friends, because that's what they do. The younger that they take them in, the more they brainwash. This punk...
Now, they had been running around for 3 or 4 years?
They were
years.
Locking her up during the day hours of school because she was only 12. They put her on a site called Backpage.com,
mm-hmm.
which is an elite, I guess, marketplace for people to find prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they were dressing her up and sending her out to Brooklyn to a place they called the Track.
The track. Mm-hmm.
So for 5 days, she already was exposed to that after they had to initiate her.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a second. After they had to initiate her, then they had her ready to go out. But she didn't have to be there for the 5 extra days if the cops had only done their damn jobs. And if Maria
uh-huh.
Bloomberg gave a damn about anything other than his own nosiness into people's households, this was the time for you to take a stand, Mayor. This was the time for the cops to show that they gave a damn. And on the 10th day, she was rescued
uh-huh.
from the physical bondage. But the mental, emotional, and traumatic experiences that she and I both went through with each other, in separate, me not knowing how to deal with my own child who looked like a complete stranger in my daughter's body, who was a whole different person, who wasn't a kid anymore, because that was where we also had a conflict, because I was too busy trying to be mommy, bringing my daughter, trying to get my daughter back to being 12 or 13. But
uh-huh.
it couldn't be, because once she was exposed to that, 13 was gone. And I had to learn that later. I had to remember that and learn it later. But that
uh-huh.
was where the conflict came. She had to deal with the fact that I was the enemy, because that's what she told her. Your mom is not really that poor. She just doesn't want to serve you anything. She doesn't want to buy you things. I got your back, baby. I'm going to take care of you. And then she wouldn't even let me see who the person was.
Uh-huh.
Neither did the DA, because I guess maybe at the time, I didn't look like I was going to leave this guy standing in 2 pieces.
Uh-huh.
So I finally got to see him when they found him a year later at his brother's house, who they were looking for another crime and wasn't really looking for him. They found him in Virginia, and I finally got to see who this little monster was that took my daughter's life. And he looked
Virginia.
Like he didn't look like he needed to be locked up. He looked like some snot-nosed kid that somebody needs to bend over their knee and beat the hell out of and then send to his room.
So he was a kid?
He was 21 years old, and he looked like he was 13. And this is what his mother let him do.
That's a double
for you
training.
You parents
so
that are twerking your babies on videos and putting them on the internet, you think real hard. Now my anger's over. So now this is the way you fight these people back. Elaine, I didn't give you, oh, I'm sorry, we have a panelist. Just a second. Welcome to the show, caller.
Yes, good evening. How are you, Katie?
I'm okay, sir. Thank you. Welcome to the show, Deacon.
God bless you. I have to commend you because
it's an awful lot of strength to come forward and put your story out here like this. My Lord. You know, I'm angry listening to the story because for the simple fact, I feel as though the city of New York and the police department of New York City let you down. And also, if this story was out there and during the time that you're describing here, Mr. Bloomberg was the mayor of this city. And it seems like everything else Mr. Bloomberg is sticking his nose in except for a tragedy like this. Why didn't he step up and try and find your daughter? 10 days? That's unheard of for a 12-year-old?
Mm-hmm.
It should have been plastered all over the New York City news. It doesn't make any sense to me because every time you turn around, it's Bloomberg this, Bloomberg that. What about the children in the city? And especially from lower-income neighborhoods or that the children that are not as well off as others, I'm pretty sure if this had been another situation, it would have been a lot more action taken. I truly do believe that. But, you know, my Lord. This thing has really got me shaken up because I can't believe that they dragged their feet the way they did for a minor child. I can't believe that. It's crazy. It really is crazy. And again, I really have to commend you for being this strong to come out and tell this story.
Thank you, sir. I did it because there are people out there who didn't get to my point of surviving it. And surviving it mentally. I don't just mean walking around a shell and being angry with the world. And this is where we're at in the panel right now. So I'm going to start with some questions, and I'll talk to you first. Because I think you also know from a victim loved one's standpoint, what do you think is the first step toward helping victims shed their victimization, and that's what I call it. It's the handcuffs of victimization. You give your opinion first.
Well, me being a spiritual person that I am, the first thing I do is pray. And I have to ask God to give me the strength to be able to forgive. And if you can start off there, and once you can get through those two things, it starts to become easier. You know, everything else will fall into place if you can bring yourself to pray for the parasite that committed this crime. Like you said, I've dealt with some tragedy in my family because within a year I lost two nieces that was killed violently. One was by her husband, was stabbed to death repeatedly in front of her two children. The other just in 2012, all these two murders happened in 2012. My other niece was shot over 9 times with a 9mm by a monster that couldn't understand. She didn't want to be bothered with him anymore. Then I had a godson that was gunned down from gang violence because he was trying to get away from the people that he was running around with, and he decided that's not what he wanted to do anymore. They didn't want to let him do that, so they shot him dead in the street. It's not easy. A lot of people say, well, you can go get counseling. I feel like this. I can't go and get counseling for somebody, talk to somebody that hasn't been through what I've been through. How are you going to tell me how to deal with something that you have no idea what I'm going through?
Absolutely. That's the absolute truth. That's the absolute banging truth. Now, yes, therapy is important, and I do have to let every, you know, it is. But you first, I'm going to tell you from being a victim myself and being a loved one of a victim. You first have to allow yourself a lot of stuff. And one of the things you have to do is first, you do have to ask God to bring you through it, especially if you are a person that's spiritual that went into it. Okay, I think forgiveness is something you ask for, but it comes down a little bit later. But it is definitely a part of the healing process. But there's a few things that I put together as I was going through this because, ladies and gentlemen, this was definitely something I felt we needed to do. But on the other hand, speaking from the mom's standpoint and the victim's standpoint, it still, as a human, makes you nervous. But first, this is the cycle. First, the crime or the trauma happens. You have to deal with whatever physical damage has happened. If you were raped, you got to deal with bruises and soreness and whatever injuries that person inflicted upon you. If you were robbed at gunpoint, if you were mugged, any of those things, that you got to deal with that. So that there goes your hospital treatment. While you're in the hospital and then beyond, you have emotional and mental damage. Why did this happen? Who was this? What did I do? What did they do? Why did they pick me? Then you have anger, but everybody thinks it's just anger about the problem. It's not. You have anger with everything, with yourself for being stupid enough to be caught there, with the culprit who did it, with the situation itself, with the people who you feel did nothing for you, be it the system, or maybe you feel like it's a loved one or a family friend or should have been there that promised you they would be and they weren't. You know, you're not thinking logically. So you have anger with that. You have anger in the world that people that exist in the first place. So you're dealing with that as well. And that anger can go into residual and exponential effects. So now we have the self-esteem problem. It had to be something about me. I must have brought this on myself. It must have been my house. It must have been the way I live. I must look like something. You deal with that. You start doubting yourself. Could I have done this better? Is there something I didn't do right? Did I not look well? I saw this coming. I had to see this coming. I'm not stupid by any means. You're dealing with that. Now you're dealing with being paranoid aware. Now everything seems like it's a conspiracy for that thing to happen to you. Everything. Oh, my God, that guy's walking and he's walking a little too funny. Okay, we got to go to the other side. That guy's a little too loud. He's talking about sex too much. I don't know. You got to get away from him. You go through that. You go through every noise you hear in your house is going to be somebody's coming in to rob you or rape you, or somebody's coming in to take your baby. Then you got to deal with the distrust of everybody. Any guy that tells you after a rape that he likes you and that he thinks you're pretty, or any woman. And you know what? This goes for male victims too. And it's harder on them because they're taught by some stupid society rule that guys are not supposed to break down or be hurt or be weak. So these poor guys are going around being raped by these horrible priests and these teachers and these people that they trust, and they can't say anything because they'll be laughed out of society. But they have to deal with that too. So now they have to deal with the fact that anybody coming with them and putting their hand around their arms or rubbing their head wants something from them. The rage that you have. I don't know where that's coming from, so whoever it is, please try to contain it. Then you have the inability later on in your adult life to really accept true love, no matter how much that person is assuring you that they're there for you, that they love you, that they love you beyond your pain, that they love you beyond what you feel are your flaws. You lose many a good people in your life because you can't accept that that's true, because you can't accept you being okay. For those that have been victims of rape or sexual assault of any kinds, a lot of sexual problems happen. Okay, you don't feel comfortable in certain positions. You don't feel comfortable with certain things. Well, I shared my story earlier. For 6 hours, this guy was holding me down and trying to get me to have an orgasm for him. And for quite some time, I couldn't. I got panicked and crazy when it came to that point in the times I had with my ex. Like there was control that was going to be coming out, and I couldn't accept the fact that this was supposed to be a pleasurable expression between myself and someone that I loved. For my daughter, she started to feel like she didn't need anybody because these people had taught her exactly how to survive for herself on the streets. So she knew how to steal something if she needed to, or, you know, work her magic, bat her eyes, use her body if need be. Broken relationships happen, not just love, but your family, your friends, because now you're snapping. They don't understand that you're not snapping at them. You're just snapping at the world, period. So they don't know how to deal with that. They don't know. So they're thinking that everything they're doing, you're just hating them. And that's why I asked all of you that were responding to me today to take a notebook and a pen and write down what you hear. Because coming from a victim and a standpoint of a loved one, understand, you might want to help, but understand a person that maybe got raped doesn't want to know that their loved one is going to go out there to go confront the person and beat them up and possibly get arrested or killed. So why don't you ask what type of help they need from you? Sometimes they just need somebody to be there and not say a word. I have another caller in. Before I continue this, I'm going to find out what they have to say. Hang on just a minute. Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. This is Terrell Ebony.
Hi, Terrell. How are you?
I am good. I have been listening, and I am overwhelmed by, you know, all of the conversation, and I definitely want to commend you for telling your story. It takes a courageous person to do that, and both you and your daughter have been through so much, and I think that by you telling this story, it's going to open the eyes and the hearts of so many. So you are doing such a great work of the Lord, and I wanted to really say that to you.
Thank you very much. Terrell, could you please tell my panel who you are?
I am Terrell Ebony. I am the founder and executive director of the Misunderstood Youth Development Center out in Kew Gardens, Queens. I work with at-risk youth that has been in trouble with the law. I'm also a parent coach and the author of Losing Love, Having Faith, and Finding Hope, which is also a family-oriented book about children surviving and dealing with certain situations with their parents after a divorce or after a breakup, and how the child feels, and, you know, children going through different emotional baggages because of their parents' baggage.
Oh, my God, that's so awesome. I had the pleasure of meeting you at the last PTA meeting at my children's school, and the work that you do is amazing. And the way that you have explained that parents need to stop feeling guilty for needing time to themselves, because you have to be good for yourself in order to be good for your children. So now, with you being on the panel, as much as I've come through these things, there's still times that I get angry. Next year, this person, and I'm giving him the benefit of the doubt by calling him that, but this person is going to go up for parole to the parole board. And my first instinct was, as much as I want to be there, I won't go because I might kill him. But I had a very special person tell me that's exactly why I need to go, not because I'm going to kill him, but because I need him to see that he didn't get over on anybody and that we're going to be there to make sure he gets his full sentence. He was sentenced 4 to 12 years. His fourth year is next year. My daughter seems to be more brave about this than me. Honestly, she advocates. She goes all over the
place. It's okay.
She was the one. Thank you, sir. She told me to go ahead with her story. She said, "Mom, that's what I advocate for. That's my advocacy group." I remember I never thought I would see the day she would come back.
Well, I'm going to interject, right? The one thing that you have is your daughter.
Yeah.
You have her. There are so many people that can't say that. There are so many children that this is happening to, and their story didn't end as well as yours did. As tragic as it is, it ended very well. And your daughter wants you to advocate for her and wants you to tell her story, and she wants other children and wants other parents to be aware that these situations do occur. However, you can move on with your life. You have to move on. And as hard as it is, honestly, Katie, you need to go to that parole hearing, not so that he can see, you know, that or that he deserves all the full sentence. You need to go there, and the reason why you need to go there has absolutely nothing to do with him, but everything to do with you and your daughter.
Yeah.
You need closure. As you said, you continue to be angry, and rightfully so, but at some point, you have to let that anger go. No one can tell you when to let that anger go, but if you don't release it, you will continue to block your blessings.
Yes.
God has blessed you, hon. He has blessed your daughter. She's there with you. He did not take her from you, so you have already been blessed. You have bigger and better things coming your way, but you don't want to allow this anger to fluster and to build and to block all the other great things that you are put in this position to do. This radio show did not come by chance. You're talking about this today did not come by chance. It is in divine order, and I said that to you. So understand that it is a healing process, and it's something that anybody in that situation will definitely go through. I am a big advocate for counseling or coaching, and there are support groups of people that have been through the same thing, and even certain counselors have been through certain things. I've been through similar situations, and I am a coach. I am a counselor. So not every counselor has not gone through. Some of them completely understand what your situation is and can talk to you about it. But it's a matter of, it's not about the counselor. And I think that that's the misconception that people have with counseling. It's not about the counselor. You're not coming to the counselor so that the counselor can go through or went through what you went through. You're going to the counselor for your own healing, for your own self-preservation. It has nothing to do with the counselor. The counselor is just a conduit.
So that I do understand. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you. I understand that. But from where Deacon Zeddy Williams is coming from, I'm going to tell you that I understand what he's saying from a victim.
I definitely do.
Because you don't, listen, it's like it's yet another stranger at first. And I'm saying at first because I'm letting the listeners out there know that you do have to see a counselor. You do. I don't care how strong you think you are. At some point, you have to, because this is a third-party person who's not involved in the situation, who has no attachment to you or anything that they could say that could make you feel less than you should feel. Because when you hear that from a family members are the worst. They are the worst. And not that they intend to be, but family members are the worst because they are so uncomfortable with watching you hurt that they don't know what to say. And what they say makes no sense. My son passed away at 3 months old, okay? I got pregnant with my daughter after him right away. And I heard the stupidest things. I mean, first of all, we had to deal with the fact that there was another baby coming so soon after the first one's death. He wasn't my first child, he was the second, but, you know, there was a baby coming. And then to top it off, people were like, oh, good, well, now you have one to replace him.
Wow.
And I don't think they meant it that way, but, like, you know, at the time I was looking, I was, you know, to get out of my house because that was the stupidest thing you could have said. And that's what I mean by loved ones. You could break a relationship because when a person's grieving or hurting, they'll say whatever makes them feel strong past their grief, because grief makes you feel like a weakling. You know, you feel like a weakling. Now, I'm going to Terrell, I'm glad that you're on the line, because this is what I and my daughter have come up with in how we started to break the cycle of the chains, except for this one little piece with this little boy, and I call him a little boy, that I have personally. I mean, my daughter, I think, has seemed to release our fear, because we had to keep her in hiding for some time, and we had to move. It was a whole bunch of stuff. But she's come to grips with the fact that she was not going to be a victim anymore when she finally came to grips that she was a victim. So this is a little bit of stuff that we came with, and I want you to tell me if you agree, okay, from the professional standpoint. Now, first, I think you got to deal with, of course, healing physically. You got to get rid of the physical signs of what happened, because if you keep looking in the mirror at that black eye you got or that scar that you got, that is like, even when your body doesn't hurt anymore, it's still a visible, you know, like visual aid of what took place. I definitely say pray through it, pray in, and people tend to think that you have to be, like, politically correct with God, and you don't, because God didn't make you politically correct. He made you his child. The way you would see a child act is the way we would act. When you're angry, tell God you're angry. He knows already. He's probably laughing that you said it, but, you know, you say, I'm angry. Why did this happen? I'm upset. Because when you start getting real in your prayer, you start getting real with yourself, and that's something I could say. Everybody tries to look up the Bible or listen to what the religious leaders said and pray that way. No, you pray from your heart, because that's what God wants from you. Now, the other thing I noticed, and this came from me as a victim, me as a mother who lost a child, and me as a mom of my daughter that got, had this happen to her. Allow yourself the time, the opportunity to grieve, to be pissed off, to be angry. And however which way that happens, be it you got to throw a plate or act out or something, you do it until you can come to grips with the fact that you are angry with it. And then acknowledge that the event happened. Don't try to deny it. And be guilt-free about the fact that it happened, because you were the victim, not the person who did it.
Absolutely.
The other thing with regards to that is that you have to tell yourself that you were a victim and that they violated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other thing was talk about it and deal with it by being constructive, be it through advocacy, fighting back by standing your ground and going to those places you try to avoid because of what happened to you. Go there. Stand there. I'm not saying visit the crime scene, because that's not healthy. That's not even smart. Not right away. But go there. Go. Everything that made you be afraid because of the incident, face it. Take somebody with you. Cry at the place. Do what you got to do, but you face it. The other thing is you have to seek support and counseling. You have to have that person that says, you can yell and scream all you want, I'm not going anywhere. And even if you're upset. But then while you're doing that, because that's the one thing I think I did wrong, and I lost quite a couple of girlfriends. Let me tell you something, listeners and parents of loved ones that were hurt and victims themselves. When you are snapping at these people, you let them know, I don't mean it at you, but I'm just mad, and I'm not being nice right now. So either you could leave if you can't take it or whatever, but it's not about you, and I hope you could forgive me later. Say it just that way, because it's real to what you're feeling at the time, but you are saying what you mean. But you say it the way you feel it, because trying to polish it up is going to make you feel more suppressed, and that's not going to help. So to this point, because there's a couple of other things, do you agree with what I'm saying, Terrell?
Most definitely. I think that your points are right on target. People definitely have to understand that it wasn't their, you know, like, you are the victim. It's not your fault. You didn't do anything to deserve what happened to you. You know, understand that you're worth more than how that person made you feel or how that person treated you. You're worth more than that. It's not anything that is personal to you. When these things happen, unfortunately, we take it personally. We take it as, why did it happen to me? Or, like you said earlier, was it something that I said, or was it the way that I was dressed, or, you know, what did I do to deserve something so, you know, so horrible, so horrific? And it really has nothing to do with you. It had everything to do with that monster that did it to you. Those were his insecurities. That was his baggage that he placed upon you. So it wasn't you directly. And it takes a while, the time, like you said, to heal and the time to really understand these things. Because when a situation like this happens, you can't tell somebody, oh, well, you know, it wasn't your fault. And they're just going to be like, yeah, I know, and kind of get over it, you know, within a day or so. That's not happening. And like you said, the people, your loved ones, they have to be able to be sensitive to your situation and give you that time to grieve, but also not allow you to sink into a deep depression or sink into a hole that will take you forever and ever to get out of. Because some people say, well, I need time to grieve, and then 10 years later they're still grieving, and they say, well, I'm
right.
still grieving. You don't. We don't want that. And that's when you have to have that balance, and you need your family and you need your friends to really kind of give you that push and that elevation to say, okay, I am ready to face the world, or at least I'm ready to face today. And we take it day by day. At some point, you might even have to take it minute by minute, you know.
Right.
But whatever it is and however slow the progression, at least it's starting. At least it's starting, and that's huge.
And there's just two more points that I wanted to I put together in this little snippet, and I wanted to see if that too is something that you would approve or back me up with, I should say. One is, and this goes to both the victim and to their support network. Victims, you do not alienate your support. You don't alienate them. Don't push them out of your life. Don't lock your doors. But at the same time, in order for you to feel that you still have some control, you got to delegate, and you have to delegate and direct your support. And what I mean by that, and this is for you, you third parties as well, allow the victim to tell you what type of help they need you to do. Like I mentioned earlier, we don't want you to go out there and go beat the culprit up for us. Okay, we don't need you to go find every person that's an arsonist and figure out if they're the person that burned your house down. We need you there. We need you to let us say how stupid we feel, how messed up we feel. And if you say, no, you're not stupid, and they go, I don't need to hear that right now, quiet. Let them say what they need to say, because that's the way you help a person, where it counts, where it can help them, not where it makes them feel like it's going to be more of a situation. And then the last thing was victims, kick victimization by succeeding 1 minute at a time. So I wanted to ask what you thought of those last two points.
I think that the first point that you made, sometimes it's a true point, but there are a lot of times when the victim may not even know what they need. They may not even know how they're feeling. They may not even know what they're thinking. They, you know, a lot of times they're just in a daze because they're still in shock, and the shock might last days. It may last weeks. You know, just for them to really acknowledge that something happened to them. So they really may need for a family member or support team to guide them and to give them, but it's just a matter of how much and knowing the balance, knowing how much to give and how much might be too much or how much might be too much to say, and know when to pull back if you feel the person is getting defensive or if you feel like it's not working, whatever it is that the support system is trying, they may need to try a few different things before they find the one thing that might actually help the victim. So with the last point that you made, that goes without saying. You know, you have to take it one step at a time. It's going to take time to heal. Time heals all wounds. That's what they say, and it's a very true saying. So little by little, you know, bit by bit, however long it takes, you do it gradually, but you keep, again, the slow progression. Just keep progressing at it.
Thank you, Taro. There's another caller. Let me just bring them in real quick. Hold on 1 second. Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? This is Dean calling from Cali. How you doing?
Hi, Dean. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to chime in on what you guys were talking about for a second. You guys were talking about going from victim and how to deal with that mentality, and I was listening to it. You know, it's harder now, like, to shapeshift from being a victim into a survivor, because back in the day it seems like this was something that people from war only had to deal with, it seemed like. But now, you know, because we are so violent, you know, and America was raised on violence, you know, murder and taking countries from people. So you know, it's almost like now everyone has to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder. It seems like that's what we're seeing more so now. You know, children who've seen their mother beat up, you know, they gotta go to school and live with that. You know, people who are seeing their children murdered and whatnot, and now they got to go home without their children. And, you know, so I think it's more so post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, that's not just in the war now, but I think that's in the city. And I was wondering how you guys feel about that. And should we address this conversation similar to that, like how you address people dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Carol, would you take that one?
Most definitely. PTSD is very, very serious, and it's very prominent in today's society for all the reasons that that you named. And certain things people don't realize is that something as simple as bullying can cause PTSD, and it lasts in your mind a lifetime, because when people do mean and vindictive and vicious things to you, those are the images, unfortunately, that stay in our mind more than the good things. You know, we tend to remember the bad things, and we tend to dwell on those things opposed to dwelling on the other good things that are happening to us. So we have to definitely understand what the mechanisms are that cause the PTSD and deal with that. And that's why the counseling is so important. And there are times, depending on, you know, the nature of the PTSD, there may even be medication that needs to be distributed. And that's why, you know, it's so important to, you know, to go to counseling and to seek the proper help when these traumatic things happen in our lives, and not necessarily feel that we can always handle everything on our own. As a parent, when you're dealing with your child that has been the victim, it's even kind of like a double-edged sword, because you're dealing with the fact that your child was, you know, victimized, but then you also have to deal with, how do I talk to my child about this? How do I comfort my child? How do I comfort the other children in the home that's witnessing these things? Because then it doesn't just that whole incident that happened, the tragedy, didn't just happen down to the victim. It's a family affair.
Oh, yes.
Because everybody now is involved. Everybody now is feeling the pain and the suffering. Everybody now wants to, you know, kind of mend fences and try to see if they can help the victim. And those are the kind of conversations that need to be had. How do we deal with it as a family unit? And knowing and having that the victim understand that they have that family support.
General, while you're there on that subject, let me share this little point. When this happened to my daughter, I had to deal with my other children believing that, you know, now once again it was about her. You understand? There was so much involved with the police, and then finding out that she, you know, she went missing from the place that she was at, and all sorts of other things. I had to deal with explaining to my other children, it's not that I'm putting you aside for her. It's that, you know, there's a person in need right now, and you guys have held it together. But mom's here for you too. It's just that she needs more of my attention, to the point of it's like immediate dangerous things that were happening. You know, we had to go to way upstate to see her because, you know, we had to get her out of the danger zone to a point. But then she was in her mode, so being that what happened, she was still acting out things that, you know, the children younger started to believe that she's doing this to herself. You know, that type of thing. My two older children that are around her age, they had to deal with residual effects from the people that took her going after them. My daughter was approached in her school where they said, oh, you must be like your sister, you know, come hang with us. My son, when he tried to defend his sister, got pushed into a wall and was like, oh, you want to do something, shorty? You know, so I had to get them out of that school and take them to another place. And it was just like everybody was a part of this. One of the things I also wanted to ask you, and I wanted to see what you feel about that, is this. when I did get to the point of saying that I'm going to go to that parole hearing, I realized why I need to go. And it's for my daughter, yes, and it definitely is for me, but I need to hear myself say to him, to his face, that I forgive him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much I'm going to mean it, but I need to say that out loud, because if I think if I hear myself say it, maybe
don't
I can get
say
to
something. Don't say anything that you don't mean.
Yeah.
Don't say
yeah.
anything that you don't mean. So if that means that you go to that parole hearing and you keep quiet and you just sit there and say nothing, then you do that. Maybe the next parole hearing you'll be ready to say, I forgive you. But if you're not
right.
ready, then don't say it, because then
right.
you'll be lying to yourself. And that's
right.
more damaging than you giving him a false hope or false belief.
Right.
So would it be okay for me to go on this first hearing to tell him just how much I wish he would just be buried under the jail, and that all those big bubble guys in there would do to him what he did to my daughter?
No, that wouldn't be okay either. I know that that's how you're feeling, and understandably. But to be quite honest with you, what you need to remember, again, is that you're a child of God.
Amen.
You are a child of God. God wouldn't want you to do that.
No.
Again, remember, he has blessed you by bringing your child back.
True. And I think between now and next year, those two things you just said will help me. And I think looking at my daughter being able to stand up to her trauma, I think she's going to be my teacher. I think it's because I feel like I was robbed of the chance to deal with it when it happened, because she protected them for so long. You know, being in the stage of victim and brainwashed victim to top it off, I think I feel like I didn't get the chance to deal with it then. Like,
let me ask you this. Do you feel as though you didn't do enough, or that some of this was your fault in some way?
I think that
you didn't protect your daughter?
I think I blamed myself for us being poor. I did, because as hard as I tried, it's like the money, you know, without help from the dad, as he was supposed to, doing it all by myself, I felt like I had to keep on stretching pennies to make everybody get an equal part of it. And as hard as I was trying, nothing was gelling, nothing. Like every time I was doing one thing that looked like it was going somewhere, something else came in the way that was more pressing, you know, and I think that, you know, with them whispering in our ear, just that, because what they do is they look for the biggest sticking point with the person that they're targeting, okay? They look for, well, if the girl is looking to be dressed well, if the girl is having problems with her mom or her dad, if she's just wild. You know, they look for what is the bait to bring them in with. And I think, too, what got me a little mad with her was I felt like after everything we've been through and all that we've overcome, you were sold out for sneakers. That's how I felt at one point. There was a one time that they had her so bad, she had said something to me that I think it took everything in my power like not to shake her, because she had said, well, at least I'm getting paid for what I do. And I said, I don't care if he gave you 50%. You're not getting paid for that. But then the mother part of me knew she was only 12 talking.
Right. So my question to you, or what I'm hearing you say, is you haven't forgiven yourself for everything that has happened. You haven't forgiven yourself.
I felt like I should have said no, even though my father said yes. I do. I feel like I should have said no that day.
Remember, again, everything happens in divine order.
Yeah.
Everything happens for a reason. At the time, you made the best decision that you could at the time. That was the decision that you made, okay? And you have to forgive yourself before you can even think of forgiving anybody else. You have to forgive yourself. You have to forgive your daughter. Because
oh,
it seems like you're still very angry at certain things that happened back then. And one of the things that we all tend to do is we linger in the past. And as
actually,
long as you live in
her,
the past.
With her, it's funny. I think I've always been this way. It's like it's always been, I put it on me, not them. But with her, as angry as I was with the situation, as hurt and scared as I was, you know, I always connected with the fact that she's a victim. I always did. And I think that to a point I was like, my God, baby, you don't even realize that these guys, this is their job. This is their job. And, so then I remember that. I remember this very well. Throughout all of this time, no matter what she said to me, no matter what we were going through, the one thing that I kept in my head was, I have to stay above this because you know what? She's in a stupid phase now. And when she comes out of this, this is going to hit her. And when it hits her, she's going to need me there to help her with her breakdown. I knew because I was an angry teen myself when all this happened to me. Okay, so that's the one thing that God did keep straight in my head no matter what other chaos. I never blamed her, ever. I think that I told her your biggest whole role in this was that you were doing what every teen does, rebelling against their parents, you know, for curfew or whatever it was. And that is exactly the way that I see it and feel it. That's why I think I'm so angry with him, because I feel like how dare you, being 21, knowing more than she knows, to target her and her immaturity. And how dare you be one human being to be able to have the power to do something and destroy a person's life. But then, like you said, I look at her now and I go, he didn't destroy a damn thing. So it's me being trivial at this moment in my anger. But I think it's more because I felt I wanted to be there, like when they were showing mugshots and stuff, to be able to look at the monster that put me through that fear and put her through that hell.
You have to let that go, because that was in the past. Whatever happened then, happened then. You have to find a way to let that go, and you have to forgive yourself for all of the shoulda, woulda, coulda.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because it has gone, it has passed, and the only way that you can truly move forward is by putting the past in the past, laying it to rest.
Yeah.
I think you're the first person on the outside that I've heard say that. I mean, I've spoken with my pastor. I've spoken with therapists. I have been to her therapy groups, and it's like nothing seemed real to me at all. Like it was all a textbook. But this is the first real outside, like just like for me, normal person, I guess, saying something that makes sense to me. You know, I honestly, this is the first time I've actually spoken about that part for some time. You know, I've always felt I pray it out. But sometimes just because you're praying doesn't mean that it gets solved on your knees. It means that when you get up, God's going to lead you to some place that you need to see it. And Terrell, I thank you for that.
Anything that I could do to help, it is my pleasure. The one thing I can tell you about prayer, and I know we have a pastor in the room that can definitely back me up on this, we can pray all the day long. God will give us all the messages in the world, but if there is no action that comes behind the prayer,
right,
it's pointless.
Sure, right.
And right. We got up to advocate, and they gave me some therapy after a while because, you know, I never was a person who gave a flying damn about anybody's opinions. I never have been. I've always been, you know, the odd girl out in a sense. So, you know, I've dealt with people talking crap. I was never a person who cared about rumors, you know, none of that. And, you know, I stand up for myself all the time. And at one point I was young, so I did it for survival. Now I do it because it just is. You know, people who don't, I always say, who don't serve needs for me that makes my life go around or not, really, you don't matter. So I don't dwell on people's opinions, because if you live by trying to please people, you're not living a life at all. because everybody can't be pleased. But one of the things that I did need, I just realized I needed to deal with that one part, which was him. And you know what? I got told too often by somebody who matters that, you know, me being this upset gives them power, and I do know that that's true, giving your culprits power. When you are upset and, you know, you don't forgive and you don't let go, they still have their a claim on your life somehow. And I'm looking at my daughter and I'm saying she was his victim. So if she can say she's not afraid and she wants to go out and see and help other people, and she came 360. When I tell you, I was dealing with a pod person. When I looked at her, I was like, I know that this is the face I gave birth to, but who are you? You know, who are you? And I had to deal with that. But then I realized one thing, too, and I think she was trying to tell me this, and I couldn't get it. I was trying to help her to become 13 again, but he exposed her to a world that 13-year-olds never should have seen. So she's not 13 anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I can't get her back to that innocent place because it's like telling her to suppress a memory that happened. And I had to learn that, you know, but she didn't give me the opportunity either because I was busy trying to fight him and fight her too. So it was like that for some time. And then I got over that because I said, wait a minute. And now I'm starting to be, you know, question my motherhood and question my way as a parent when I know that every day I woke up and I went to sleep knowing that even though I had only this much, most of that much went to them. And I go to sleep every night knowing that I'm clear conscience in the way that I take care of them. So when the guilt didn't work on her, and I think that the day that she started to get a little shake was on Christmas, Christmas of 2012 or 11, when I said to her, wait a minute, I've been going back and forth with you with stuff you know you're not telling the truth about, but you know you get a reaction from me in a way. Guess what? The day that I had you, I gave you back to God, and God promised me that as long as I teach you in the ways of him, no matter how far you go, you ain't going to fall far from the tree you were brought up from. So with that, the only thing I could do is say this. I pray that God points you to the trigger in you that makes you connect where you need to connect, and I pray that God keeps you safe because you don't know how to do that for yourself right now. And then I pray that God makes me strong enough to be there for you when all of this stuff, he puts you in front of a mirror and you come crashing down because you will. And you know what? 3 days ago, my daughter came to me and said, Mommy, for the first time in my life and since this happened, I need to tell you that I'm sorry for everything you went through.
Mom. Right. Can you guys still hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to add in too, you know, like, you know, I know we're talking about God and stuff like that, but, you know, I also want people to, you know, to say that there's a consequence for your actions, you know, and stuff like that, and that's the lesson here. You know what I mean? You know, the parent can blame themselves or we can blame the person or whatever, but at the end of the day, you know, there was the person can shape-shift yourself from a victim to what was my part in it. You know what I mean? And be accountable for what you did and your ownness in it. And that's how you get your power back, by saying, okay, I'm going to learn the lesson. What was my part in this and stuff like that? And that's how you come out of that victim mode, by owning what you did and saying, I'm going to learn the lesson and I'm not going to do that part anymore. Yes, there was a perpetrator that did what they did, but at the end of the day, there's consequences for our actions. And you know,
well,
we just got to be real with that.
Let me ask you a question on what you just said. What about a person that just walked out of their job, stood at a bus stop, you know, did everything right, and somebody walked up, whacked them on the head, and took something from them? You know, what about a person that didn't go dressed up in a bad way or come out late or do whatever and got raped?
Right.
I mean, there's a whole lot. Yes, if you were in a position that you saw something coming or you've been warned not to be there and you went anyway, yes, there's a consequence reaction. But what about somebody who doesn't know you at all? Walking up
well,
to you
well, well I'm just speaking like, I'm speaking not in general, but, you know, just basically for situations wherein, you know, you have at-risk teens doing certain situations and stuff like that, there's a consequence, you know, for those kind of actions, you know. And again, you know, I agree that, you know, what they experience affects how they act, you know, because, like, some things you can never unsee and or unhear. So when people tell you to just get over it and forget it, you know, I'm saying you ain't never going to be able to unsee what you saw or unhear what you saw. So that's not realistic to tell someone just get over it and move forward. You just got to deal with that differently, you know, because that's always going to be with you. And
let's just
be real in this conversation.
Yeah, it always will be real. You're right. You can't unring a bell. That's absolutely true. But the whole point of this thing is of this segment today is to have people learn how to do just that. And like you said, for those situations that do apply, for example, your parents told you not to go to that party because there were people that were there that everybody knows is trouble. And then a shootout happens and that person gets shot. You know, who would they blame for being there? You understand? I mean, that's one thing.
One reason I say it, because I have a daughter, you know, she was with an abusive relationship with a boyfriend. And, you know, when she was coming up against me and stuff, like, the reason I found out, because the paper came to my house one day that said that, because they thought she's still living with me instead of living with him, and it says the restraining order is now lifted and whatnot. And when I found that out, I was like, I called her to the house one day, and then I kept her and I grabbed her phone and stuff like that, and I told her what was going on. I showed her the letter, and she denied, and she said, well, you know, I hit him too and whatever, you know, and it was like something that we did together. And so when I started calling her friends for the truth, you know, she fought me. I took her phone and ran around the house calling her friends, and they told me the whole truth, that it was ongoing, that he would choke her up at parties and whatnot, that, you know, he beat her up on the steps or whatever, at, you know, in front of them, and that a couple of them, and then she was screaming through the phone, well, if you tell him daddy, I'm gonna tell y'all daddy that, and come to find out, she was saying, yelling out stuff that their boyfriends was beating them up too. And it was a normal routine thing. She said, since you tell my daddy, I'm gonna tell the same thing. And so, you know, they accept this behavior. A lot of these kids or whatever, you know, they accept it and live in secrecy. And I say that's a thing too, you know, wherein with the parents or whatever, you know, I had to literally be proactive and snatch her phone and do the spy thing, you know. So I encourage parents to spy on their children, you know, because,
yeah,
you know, them children are so secretive and so bad these days, you know what I mean? They're in so much stuff that by the time you find out about it as a parent, you don't find out about it till the boyfriend come home and shoot you. And you didn't even know that they had broke up or in that he was threatening her or whatever. You know, you turn on TV and a parent get murdered, you know. So children be putting their parents in a lot of situations these days. And so to be proactive, you know, I would say spy on your children, you know, and stuff like that. And I know that might be a bad message to some, but, you know, you can save their life, you know, and stuff like that,
yeah,
by
yeah,
checking
yeah.
their emails and, you know what I mean, and checking,
yeah,
you know, their phone calls or whatever, or talking to their friends and whatnot.
Yeah, let me interject into that. When we were coming up, that spy thing, spy on your children, that wasn't a problem because, I mean, anything that I did, believe me, my mother was on top of it. And this was before,
right,
I was in teenager, you know. If I came home and went up into my room, believe me, she would give me a few minutes to get up there, and if I was getting into something, she'd give me enough time to get into it. But then all of a sudden, before I knew it, if I turned around, she was there.
Exactly.
You know? Parents were more attentive to their children back then. Now
and
it seems like parents that want to push the kids out of the home and buy them video games to get them out of their hair, or push them on off to school and figure like the school is going to raise their child. No, that is not the case. The foundation with your child starts at home. What they learn from their parents, the foundation that they pick up at home is where it all starts. You know, we can't put all the responsibility on these teachers, because we have to have these children prepared before they get to school. Before they start grade school or anything, we as parents have a responsibility. The word says teach a child in the way they should go. And that's not happening today with a lot of parents. And it's sad. And because and to be really straight with this, eventually we're going to have to answer to that, because all of these children are gifts from God. They are His jewels, and they are, and the ones that are blessed enough to have these children need to realize these jewels from God. You're going to have to answer to them. What did you do with these blessed gifts that I gave you? Did you teach them the right way to go? Did you teach them how to live their lives?
And you know, plus, I would say, like, the majority of these parents that tell you, I raised my
children,
child.
And my goodness, where have we lost it?
Yeah, we have. We certainly have. And you're right, Deacon. The teachers are supposed to be a support system, not the primary caretakers.
Right.
And the other thing that I say is this. In my house, if you are under 18, you have no privacy. You are subject to a drive-by inspection by me at all times, which is exactly how I got into finding out what my daughter was starting to get into. I do have to take a little break. I will be back in 3 minutes. Please, no, none of you go anywhere. This is
okay.
The upcoming R&B group sensation, the three young sisters that's spreading positivity. This is their gospel track. It's okay. We'll be back.
All right.
Now, back with more On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. We are in the midst of a wonderful, very emotional journey for me, discussion with very active and intriguing panelists this evening. We have Ms. Terrell Ebony, who is a parent coach, and she has been very helpful in helping me and contributing to this discussion, part one of our three-part series of how to kick victimization in the butt. So pretty much that's it. I'm going to be bringing our panelists in right now, staying with me. Rod, are you there? Deacon, are you back?
Yes.
Okay. Daryl?
I'm here.
Okay. We have 10 minutes left in the segment. Rod, you've been a little quiet out there. You want to fill in on anything that you heard today? Okay. I'll go to you, Daryl. You have any final remarks?
I just want to say that victimization is going to be as long as we allow it. And it is a healing process. Support is needed. It takes time to heal all wounds.
Yes, yes.
Love yourself. Love yourself. Give yourself permission to grieve. Give yourself permission to be angry. Give yourself permission to lash out and do all of the things that you need to do. And all those things are negative, right? But when you finish doing all of those things, give yourself permission to heal. Give yourself permission to love again. Give yourself permission to also forgive. Give yourself permission to move on and not stay stagnant. Give yourself permission to no longer be the victim.
Amen. Thank you for that very much. Deacon.
Yeah, I also would like to add to that. As she says, give yourself permission to do that. You have to be a person that's strong in their faith and believing that they can get through anything. The Bible says faith without works is dead. So if you have faith and you don't put in work to make sure that faith gets stronger and stronger every day, it's going to die. You have to nourish it, treat it like it's a precious flower. And it's just like our children. We have to, you know, feed into the knowledge and education and wisdom that has been poured in us from the Creator. It has to keep going through them. And people, please, pay close attention to your children. You know, they are so much more advanced than we were when we were coming up. We need to pay attention to them. And be careful what you do and say around your children, because they are sponges. They'll pick it up. They don't have to see or hear it but one time. So let's start being more responsible parents. And one thing for sure, if you're going to be a parent, be a parent. You can't be a parent and a friend. That's just like trying to mix oil with water. It's not going to work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. And Deacon and Daryl and all of our other guests this evening, I thank you all very much for finding this show to be worthy enough to be here. I appreciate it. I appreciate the moral support to my listeners out there. Real World Black News and Discussions Group, as usual, you're always very active in supporting, and I appreciate it. This was hard for me, and maybe not so much for my daughter, but it was a little hard for me, but I actually don't regret coming forth, because it is also my testimony and it is what makes the show a mission. It's myself and three other people on this panel that all have been involved with something that made this show a mission to do for others. And I appreciate people like you, Deacon and Daryl, for, you know, taking the time out of your day to not suffer with what I call the NIMBY disease, which is not in my backyard. Yeah. And to those of you that are out there that have been through this, she's right. Deacon's right, and from a victim and the loved one of a victim, kick victimization in the butt 1 minute at a time. Don't say one step. Take it a minute. Every minute you can breathe past it and still stand, and you are strong. That means you've overcome. It is hard. Don't get upset when you have a little bit of a flashback to what happened and you might have a little reaction, but just know that you're stronger than the last minute. So when you have that, deal with it, breathe it out, move on to the next minute, because each minute is strength. So until tomorrow, well, not tomorrow, because I will be at the Comedy Cares event, and I would like for all of you to please attend this fundraiser if you're in the New York area. It is for comedians trying to get health care and promoting men's health awareness and it is only $10. It's tax deductible. It will be at 10 Reed Street at the Albella Lounge tomorrow. There's going to be a whole lineup of famous comedians doing their thing for charity. So please, to contact Stephanie Hammond on Facebook for the Simply Sensational, Inc. event that's going to go on tomorrow. OTE will be there. On the Edge will be there tomorrow. And then Wednesday will be part two of this segment, and Thursday will be our conclusion. So please join us here on Wednesday, 8:30 live. Tomorrow you can hear a replay of the live interview with the legendary comedians Kenny Williams and Sugar Bear, who is suffering with prostate cancer, and he is one of the advocates for men's health awareness. He's also an honoree at tomorrow's fundraiser, along with comedian Raj G, who suffered a stroke. So please, if any of you are there, please be out there. Deacon, once again, thank you. Terrell, once again, thank you. Rod, Elaine, Dean from Cali, thank you. Real World News and Discussions Group, thank you. PS37 in Queens, thank you. God bless all of you, and I will see you here Wednesday night at 8:30.
All right, be blessed.
Be blessed. Take care.
On the Edge, we'll talk about real issues.